Hey, you. Yeah, you. Do you like cracking into curious creatures? Perhaps you ponder the paranormal. Have you ever got a hankering for the haunted? Ever entertained the existence of extraterrestrials? Or have you ever just wanted to hear genuine encounters of any kind? If you have answered yes to any of these questions, then Cryptids, Creeps, and Conspiracy Podcast is right up your alley. So grab your sense of humor and open your mind as we take a journey to uncover the mysteries behind kooky critters, spooky specters, enigmatic entities, and the controversial conspiracies that surround them. Buckle up, because we're going to have a good time.
You are listening to Perplexity.
The first job I ever had was at a water park called NRH2O. I can remember working there like it was yesterday. I always looked forward to going, even though I made less than minimum wage, which was somehow legal at the time. And despite the Texas heat, the really bad bumblebee problem that we had, where they were crawling into the soda machine nozzles, I was always excited because it was my first job, all of my friends worked there, and it was a place that I knew people could have fun. But that is not what we are talking about today, or at least not exactly. Today we're talking about horrific incidents, unimaginable things that have happened at water parks. As we close out this summer of 2024, today I'm going to share with you three of the arguably most dangerous water parks to have ever existed. First, we are going to discuss the Bonsai Pipeline slide disaster. Then you will hear all about the Verruckt slide disaster. And finally, we will close out this episode by discussing Action Park. And if you end up wanting to learn more about Action Park, I would encourage you to check out my Patreon, where I do a much deeper dive into that third story. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I am your host, Kadra. If you're new to the show, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me, so if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And if you end up enjoying today's episode, I would encourage you to continue to follow along. If you're a returning listener, hello, my friends. Welcome back. So happy you're here. I have a wild story for you guys today, but very quickly before we get into that, as usual, we're at the top of the show, so just a couple of quick reminders and announcements. I have a lot of bonus content continuing to come out on Patreon. So if that interests you, patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast is where you can get all of that. I also now have ads on the show. So just a reminder, you can get episodes early and ad-free on Patreon for just $1 a month. If you want bonus content, that is at the $3 and above tiers. I have my Austin, Texas serial killer episode out. I will have an episode that's going to accompany this one that will be on Patreon, where we discuss a lot more about the Action Park and the documentary that came out in 2020 about it called Class Action Park. And if you guys have not done so yet, just wanted to remind you to please leave 5-star reviews wherever you get your podcasts, because that really helps the show. Also, if you are watching on YouTube and you have not done so yet, please hit the subscribe button so that you can continue to keep up with the latest episodes. Big trigger warning for today's episode. Today we are getting into some pretty disturbing and very heavy content, so extreme caution is advised in today's episode, and all of the sources that were used for today's episode will be available down in the show notes. So let's get into this first water park. Among the most infamous theme parks are Six Flags and Hurricane Harbor. Located in Concord, California, and originally owned and operated by Premier Parks, you would find Six Flags Hurricane Harbor Concord, changing its name and being branded as a Six Flags Water World in 2004. And later, it became Water World California in 2007. But before all of this, the park originally had the name Waterworld USA Concord, and it opened to the public in 1995. The park spanned over 20,000 square feet and would average around 2,000 visitors per day. Each year, the park would close down when it got cold, but when it reopened, they would often advertise a new attraction, hoping to flock in more visitors. So in the year of 1997, the new attraction they would advertise was the Bonsai Pipeline Slide. This was an open-air bonsai pipeline that included six white, twisty, turny water slides. And it was a pretty big deal. Literally, it was the tallest structure among the 10 water attractions in the park, sending riders down more than three stories. It was often easily spotted throughout the park because it was, number one, insanely tall, and number two, it sported pink and blue flags on the top. The ride was thrilling and very quick. Riders slid down for only about 15 seconds. Then they would land in a 3-foot deep pool. One lifeguard was always posted at the top, while another was at the bottom. The slide did not have any type of raft. It was a single rider slide. And quickly after the slide opened up to the public, tragedy would strike. On June 2nd, 1997, the Bonsai Pipeline would collapse after a group of 33 senior students from Napa High School had piled into the water slide in an attempt to break a school record. The record and tradition of the school was for the seniors to try to fit as many people into the water slide at once as they could. The students called this clogging. The students had been hanging out at the park all day for their senior picnic, celebrating their upcoming graduation. Seniors from prior years had gone clogging at other water parks, but this was the first year they would ever do it here. The seniors would rush to the top of the Waterworld Bonsai Pipeline, quickly running past the lifeguard, jumping into the slide, laughing and screaming. The students were especially in a rush because an announcement had just rung out over the park's speakers, telling 120 seniors that the buses had arrived and it was time to round up and head home. So a large amount of the seniors had already headed out and were waiting on the buses, but others were still hanging out throughout the park. Among the group of the sliders that would do this clogging were a lot of English class honors students and at least seven of the starters on the soccer team. When the students rushed past the lifeguard, she quickly blew her whistle and yelled at the teenagers to stop. Additional staff and security would also rush to the slide, but they were too late. The students slid down holding hands, and they would grip onto the sides of the slide, clogging it as water rushed toward them. Part of the slide would give way and split open, creating a massive gap between one part of the slide and the other, and this would result in dozens of students plunging 37 feet down to the base of the slide, which contained nothing more than concrete, dirt, and brush. Bodies were literally falling out of the sky. A man that was attending Waterworld that day, Russ Tabiero, would say, quote, "I saw a line of kids on the slide, and then more kids piled on, and then more kids piled on. The slide broke. It cracked, rolled, and dropped. There were people hanging on it as it was falling," end quote. Other witnesses would say they heard a loud crashing noise and then saw the slide crack at about 3:30 p.m., followed by loud crunching noises, then cries of pain. As the chute snapped, one group of teenagers clumped together and fell, then another group, with many banging against the wooden support beams on the way down. As the water spilled from the slide, witnesses would say the water was stained red with blood. The The students would lay in a heap of debris until rescue teams arrived, and meanwhile, park workers would try to help the students as much as they could. And this incident would prove deadly because not only were there 32 injured, there was one teenage girl who died as a result of this clogging incident. She was a 17-year-old female student named Quimby Galati, and Galati was among one of the last of the riders to go down. She would unfortunately suffer a severe head injury during the fall, and she would later pass away at Mount Diablo Medical Center around 4:15 p.m. She had sustained severe head and chest injuries. Galati was known as a vivacious young lady. She was a member of the school's mock trial club, and she was very smart, a super active student. Other people that were injured were taken to 9 area hospitals, with several in serious condition and at least 3 left in critical condition. Initially, it was also difficult to identify who all of these students were because whenever they had gone into Waterworld, they had checked their IDs at the gate. The spokesman for Premier Parks Incorporated, Brent Gooden, would express sympathy for the victims and their families while also saying, quote, "Based upon what we know at this point, we believe this slide was safe. We are still gathering the facts on precisely what happened." End quote. The following week, over 800 students would attend a memorial service commemorating Galati. Many friends would also attend, still wearing casts and trying to recover from injuries from the incident. City officials would also quickly hire a private building inspector to look at the ride to help determine the cause of the accident. It was stated that the slide experienced weight forces 3 to 4 times greater than it was designed to hold. However, according to Fred Langford, a New Jersey architect who does not have any association with the slide should have never failed. Langford has designed dozens of other water rides, and he feels that the slide should not have been capable of collapsing in this situation. The slides were supported by steel and concrete. According to Langford, the incident was very unusual, and Police Lieutenant Jim Jennings would later say Waterworld up until that point had been pretty much a trouble-free space. This was the first major incident at the park. At this time, there was no uniform building code practice for water slides. Though, according to architect Langford, water park constructors are still required to meet stringent standards. The practices, of course, vary slightly state to state, but in California, the law clearly says that slide construction must be approved by city or county building inspectors. And Concord City officials had inspected and approved the building of the Bonsai Pipeline slide. The park ended up remaining closed Tuesday, the day after this incident, and eventually park officials would later say to the public that Waterworld would close indefinitely. But just about 2 weeks later, on a Saturday, the park opened again. There was a small but enthusiastic crowd that showed up, and city officials had deemed it safe that Friday. Galati's mother, a woman named Victoria Nelson, would stand outside of the park that day, holding a sign reading, "I'm Quimby's mom." She would say to press, quote, "I'm here to remind people what happened to my daughter. I just want people to think about her. I'm here for my daughter," end quote. The slides of the Bonsai Pipeline remained closed, but park visitors could still clearly see the area where all of this had occurred. Park officials wore pink ribbons that day in memory of Galati, as her nickname was the Pink Princess. The park was also swarming with additional security and staff, including uniformed security guards posted at each slide. There were also numerous signs reminding everyone of the safety rules. Within a few weeks, Waterworld would add turnstiles as well to prevent more than one person at a time from going on a slide. The father of Galati, Larry, would file a wrongful death suit against the park, calling the ride defective, dangerous, and broken. Premier Parks Incorporated would admit to no wrongdoing, saying that every public agency that investigated the incident concluded the slide was safe. Other students' families would also sue Waterworld, saying that the slide was too flimsy and park supervision was inadequate. Additionally, victims and victims' families would accuse Napa school officials for not taking proper action when they allegedly heard a group of students talking about their plans to clog the slide that day. Altogether, there would be 24 lawsuits filed by victims, with 14 of them reaching a $4 million settlement. Quimby Galati's death triggered improved regulation of California amusement parks. Her family settled in a negligence lawsuit for $1.7 million. However, in this settlement agreement, none of the defendants admitted liability, including Waterworld USA, its parent company Premier Parks Incorporated, Slidemaker, Whitewater West Industries, or the Napa Valley Unified School District. So basically, the families and the victims all sued these four entities together in this settlement agreement. And they did settle, they did get money, but none of these companies admitted to wrongdoing. Many understandably find this story to be quite controversial. A lot of people say that the park should not have had to have shelled out any money. While it is tragic, the students didn't abide by the rules, so a lot of people don't think that this is fair. But with Langford sharing some interesting opinions about the safety of the slide and other engineers having varying opinions about all of this, I am a little bit skeptical. I also read some pretty interesting Google reviews that you guys might want to look up about this place. There were basically just a lot of people talking about how it just seems like the park is not run very well. It's not very good with like safety regulations. A lot of people said it was like dirty, that the food wasn't good, not properly cooked, things like that. But nevertheless, this park does remain open to this day, including the Bonsai Pipeline. Now, unlike this first story, who was at fault is not even remotely up for debate. For this next story, I am going to take you to Kansas. And this story is hands down one of the most horrifying stories I have ever heard, and definitely the most horrifying story from a water park, as far as I know. Listener discretion is advised. If you've ever wondered what the tallest water slide was in the world, look no further than the Verrucht Slide that was in Kansas. Schlitterbahn Water Park in Kansas City, Kansas is one of Kansas's most popular water parks and one of five Schlitterbahns in the country. I myself have been to a couple of Schlitterbahn locations. The Schlitterbahn in Kansas City features 14 water slides and two pools. And in this park, there once stood a multi-rider water slide taller than Niagara Falls and the Statue of Liberty. It was the main attraction, standing at 169 feet tall. The ride was called Verrucht, which is a German word meaning insane. Riders would plummet down a nearly vertical 17-story chute going upwards of 70 miles per hour. This would require the riders to wear seat belts, and soon after the grand opening, the Verrucht was certified as the world's tallest water slide by the Guinness Book of World Records. There was a big ceremony gathering hundreds of people, including city officials. The park opened to the public in July of 2014, and thrill seekers would flock from far and wide to experience the world's tallest water slide. It would take a while before the Verrucht would be open to the public, though. The slide opening ended up being pushed back multiple times due to safety concerns. And we'll talk a lot more on that later. But when the ride finally opened, it was a hit. According to Texas Monthly, the ride was the most amazing ride ever ridden. It was like dropping out of the sky. It was terrifying and horrible and terrific all at the same time. But all of that would change on August 7th, 2016. Born on January 23rd, 2006 in Kansas, Caleb Thomas Schwab was one of four boys. His household was full of life and energy. He enjoyed playing outdoors, and he was part of a local baseball team called the Mudcats. His father was a man named Scott Schwab, and he was actually a member of the Kansas House of Representatives at the time that all of this occurred. When Caleb was just 10 years old, he would go to Schlitterbahn Water Park for a day of fun with his family. The Schwabs had attended church earlier that morning, then they headed out. It was perfect to them because that day, Schlitterbahn was actually offering free admission to Kansas elected officials and their families in honor of Elected Official Day. Scott Schwab would later recall how ecstatic his son Caleb was from the time they stepped foot in Schlitterbahn. Caleb's 12-year-old brother Nathan had one thing in mind that day. He wanted to ride the world's tallest slide. So the way that Scott recalls it is pretty much as soon as his family walked into the park, his 12-year-old son, Nathan, made a beeline for the Verrucht, and 10-year-old Caleb followed him. Patiently, the two young boys would bide their time, slowly climbing the 264 stairs to get to the top of the Verrucht. When it was finally the boys' turn to go, at the last minute, Caleb and Nathan ended up being split up because of a weight requirement that they weren't meeting if they slid down together. So Nathan would go first in a different group. Nathan went down no problem. He laughed, screamed, had a great time, and anxiously waited for his little brother Caleb to come down. Soon after, Caleb would step into a three-person raft riding in the front, while two adult sisters sat behind him. These women were unrelated to Caleb. Meanwhile, away from both of the boys were Scott and his wife, Michelle. They were relaxing and taking care of the younger kids. But soon, Scott and Michelle heard screaming. And the screams sounded familiar, so they turned around and they see their 12-year-old son, Nathan, red-faced, screaming, and sprinting towards them. Nathan would scream to his parents, quote, "He flew from the Verrucht, he flew from the Verrucht," end quote. Water park staff would respond to reports of a loud boom and an injured boy at the Verrucht. When help would arrive, they would find Caleb Schwab's lifeless body floating in the pool at the bottom of the slide. Nathan had witnessed the whole thing. Because of the sheer force of this ride on the second hill, which was more than 50 feet tall, Caleb's raft went airborne and he was actually ejected from the raft and slingshotted into the emergency netting enclosure that was at the top of the slide, a couple feet above it. He hit a metal bar that was supporting the safety net, and again, because of the impact, Caleb was killed instantly. He was killed in an incredibly gruesome manner. If you do not want to hear this, I would recommend you fast forward about 10 seconds. Caleb hit his head so hard on the slide that he was actually decapitated. And the two sisters that had been riding with Caleb would be covered in his blood, having to witness this entire tragedy. The two sisters also suffered severe physical injuries, including a broken jaw and other bone fractures. The area was quickly blockaded as the scene was incredibly gruesome. Video footage shows the slide, though, covered with blood. And as horrific as all of this is, as unimaginable as this is, the park would open 3 days later. Meanwhile, the Verrucht remained closed for investigation. But the story of how Caleb Schwab lost his life at just 10 years old started long before he stepped foot into that park. The investigation into Caleb's death would reveal gross negligence from the amusement park, the city, and the designers. In an interview with Esquire, an anonymous lifeguard would say they felt it was only a matter of time before someone lost their life on that slide. So you might be wondering, who designed this death trap? Enter Jeff Henry and John Schooley. Jeff Henry was a co-owner of Schlitterbahn, and Henry and Schooley had quickly constructed variations of the Verrucht several times, but they were often left unsatisfied. To them, the slide wasn't fast enough, crazy enough. It had to be bigger and better. After all, they were being filmed for a reality TV show about amusement parks. When Henry and Schooley would build a new variation of the Verrucht and test it, they would only allow a small number of loyal employees to see these test runs. Jeff Henry would say about the slide, quote, "We had many issues on the engineering side. A lot of our math was based on roller coasters at first, and that didn't translate to a water slide like this. No one had ever done anything like this," end quote. John Schooley, the other designer, would say he, quote, "didn't know whether he was going to survive." when he did this run on the slide himself, because he didn't know if they had figured it out yet. In the documentary, The Water Slide, produced by The Atlantic and filmmaker Nathan Truesdell, you can see footage of Schooley saying this after a test run. The footage shows Henry and Schooley throwing sandbags into the rafts, laughing and smiling, and them repeatedly becoming airborne during testing. One clip even showed the raft fully removing itself from the Verrucht, falling on its side and crashing into the rocks below. At that time, they had not installed the safety net yet, and Schooley would later call the ride safe, dangerous. So when Henry and Schooley built their final version of the Verrucht, they added a second hill, the one that would later kill Caleb Schwab. Because of the airborne raft, Schooley and Henry's solution was to build emergency netting. Problem solved. Well, physical evidence would continue to show other rafts had gone airborne and collided with the overhead netting prior to Caleb Schwab's death. Following an investigation into Caleb's death, Jeff Henry and John Schooley, along with general contractor Henry & Sons Construction Company, would be indicted on charges of aggravated battery, aggravated endangerment of a child, interference with law enforcement, and involuntary manslaughter. Henry faced a charge of second-degree murder. The state would say that the men skipped fundamental steps in their design process, using nothing more than crude trial-and-error methods for their safety testing. There's also video evidence of the designers talking about how they had consulted with experts, engineers, physicians, mathematicians, and all of them telling them that this would not work and that it was unsafe. So what was Schooley and Henry's response, you might ask? That they didn't know what they were talking about. They were all wrong and they would prove them wrong. Additionally, Schooley and Henry had a disturbing lack of qualifications, in case you hadn't figured it out yet. Jeff Henry had no prior education outside of high school, and Schooley did not have any type of mechanical engineering background. Henry and Schooley literally used crude trial and error methods to build a death trap. And perhaps the most damning piece of evidence at all that came from this investigation was thus. 1 week before the ride opened, an outside engineering firm inspected the ride and told them that it was, quote, guaranteed that rafts would occasionally go airborne in a manner that could severely injure or kill the occupants, end quote. This would often happen on the second hill where Caleb was killed. There were also a lot of concerns with Schlitterbahn's operations manager, Tyler Miles. He would end up also being charged with manslaughter, and he had a history of covering up prior accidents at the park. Video evidence would be compiled by the Travel Channel and a number of other internal reports that would reveal willful negligence on Miles' part. There were multiple cases, at least 13 others, where people were injured on the Verrucht, and Miles would downplay these injuries and or cover them up. Injuries would include concussions, herniated discs, and swollen eyes. So surely, with all of these facts, Henry, Schooley, and Miles would face some type of legal ramifications. Henry and Schooley would go to jail, right? Wrong. All the legal charges were dropped in early 2019 by Judge Robert Burns, citing lack of evidence. According to the judge, the footage from the Travel Channel was dramatized and disingenuous. He also called the testimony of one of the witnesses in this case unreliable and stated that Henry and Schooley did not break any ride safety laws. Because why, you might ask? Oh, because Kansas had virtually no laws about this at the time. Kansas law did require seatbelts, barricades, and brakes, but unlike other states like Missouri, Kansas was not required to have state inspections. Inspections are also not made public and do not have to be turned over to the state. In 2017, the Schwabs did settle with Schlitterbahn Water Park for $20 million. Most of the money was put into a scholarship fund called Can I Go Play, which was one of the things that Caleb would always ask his parents when he wanted to go outside. The aim of the program was to help disadvantaged children be able to play sports. And from what I could find, this scholarship is no longer available. Scott, Caleb's father, was also able to use his political career as a Kansas state representative to push more firm regulations for amusement parks. New legislation would end up passing, requiring amusement park rides be inspected annually by an inspector certified by one of several national boards, along with either a certified engineer with at least 2 years' experience or someone with 5 years' experience in the amusement park industry. They also made it a law that if anyone is injured in an amusement park and notifies staff, the incident has to be reported to the state. The Verrucht would also be torn down after Caleb's death, and on May 1st, 2018, IBC Bank took over ownership of the park following a foreclosure auction. Schlitterbahn did continue to operate while a new owner was sought, and then the property was rebranded as Waves Resort Corpus Christi. The park closed during 2020 due to COVID and never reopened. By 2021, the park was demolished, and I say good riddance. How incredibly pig-headed and irresponsible these men were. The actions of Schooley, Henry, and Miles are truly despicable, and in my opinion, these men should have gone to prison for manslaughter. No question. I truly hope that the Schwab family has been able to move forward and are at peace with this. I cannot imagine the horror that they had to have gone through with this. Now for this final story, I am going to be taking you to Vernon Township, New Jersey. And let me just say up front, when I learned about this place, my mind was absolutely blown. Action Park opened up to the public in May of 1978 on the grounds of the Great Gorge Ski Resort. But the story begins with Gene Mulvihill, who was a rich stockbroker and schemer. He had basically hatched this idea that he could build this epic, lawless amusement slash water park and make some serious cash. Mulvihill had a hands-off philosophy, and he believed in minimal regulatory oversight. And of course, what theme park would be complete without a great deal on alcohol? Mulvihill's brainchild would soon come to fruition, and the end result would be innumerable injuries and six deaths. The injuries are literally impossible to count because the park didn't keep count. Because of the danger, the park quickly gained the name Accident Park. And there is a documentary that came out about this in 2020. You can watch it on HBO Max. It is called Class Action Park. And that is the documentary I dive much deeper into this story about on Patreon. In the late 1970s, Action Park was ahead of its time. It was among the first of modern constructed water parks in the United States, and it wouldn't take long for visitors to come flocking in. It was at its peak during the 80s and would entertain over a million visitors with upwards of 12,000 each weekend. The park was both an amusement and a water park, including a wide variety of attractions, and the park was split into three main areas: Water World, the Alpine Center, and Motor World. So let's talk about some of these attractions. First, I have to start with the Cannonball Loop. This was an enclosed water slide that literally had a complete 360 vertical loop, like a roller coaster. Nothing like this had ever been built. The riders were weighted, hosed down with cold water, and instructed to remove any jewelry. Then they were carefully instructed on how to position their bodies. They had to go down feet first, arms crossed over their chest. It didn't take long for patrons to become injured during this ride. They were getting bloody noses, teeth were getting knocked out, there were back injuries, and even head injuries. According to urban legend, when the slide was first constructed, park owners would send test dummies down it, and dummies were often coming down decapitated, and or dismembered. This urban legend was allegedly confirmed later to be true by Andy, Gene Mulvihill's son. Andy spoke with the New York Times about this in 2019, and safety issues were the least of Mulvihill's concerns. So long as he was making money, everything seemed right with the world. We can draw these conclusions quite easily from his actions. Instead of consulting with professionals like engineers or risk assessors, Mulvihill would offer his employees $100 to personally test out the slide. Multiple employees would take this money because they were young teenagers and didn't know any better, probably needed the cash, but they would often end up with injuries. One worker would claim that there was a hatch that ended up having to be installed in the slide right where the loop-de-loop was because people kept getting stuck. The first time this happened, they didn't have a hatch there, and they ended up having to crack open the slide to get them out. Some riders also started ending up with mysterious lacerations all over their bodies. They would get to the bottom of the slide and be like, "Why am I covered in these scratches?" So eventually, the ride was surprisingly closed for a little bit to determine what was causing these scratches. I guess that's more serious than a head injury, but neither here nor there. So they crack open the slide, and inside they would find the cause of these lacerations. Human teeth. People who had been riding down the slide and had lost teeth, had bloody mouths. Their teeth were embedded in the walls of the slide and leaving scrapes on new riders' bodies. A former Navy physician would also later find that the cannonball loop was forcing riders to experience upwards of 9 G's of force when they would go down it. This is 3 times greater than the force that astronauts experience when they are taking off into outer space. The cannonball loop was eventually shut down by the advisory board on Carnival Amusement Ride Safety, and this would actually happen about 1 month after it opened. But this did result in many, many injuries. There was also the Alpine Slide, and this was a 2,700-foot-long slide that descended down the mountains. Remember, this was right by a ski resort, so you would take these ski lifts to get to the top of the slide, and then you had this insanely long slide that cascaded down the mountaintop. It looked beautiful, and you probably had a great view going down, but it was incredibly dangerous. When riders would go down this slide, they had to sit on these tiny sleds with a control stick, and the stick would either brake or accelerate. But the stick that was used to control these sleds was often broken. It also often seemed to only have 2 options. You could either go incredibly fast or insanely slow. The Alpine slide would quickly result in riders suffering from serious cuts and bruises. Injuries would often come from the slide itself, as it was made of concrete, fiberglass, and asbestos. And on July 8, 1960, this slide would prove deadly. A 19-year-old boy named George Larson Jr. would be thrown from the slide after his sled jumped the track. His head would forcefully strike against the rocks below, causing George to fall into a coma. He fought for his life for 8 days before he passed, and Action Park would quickly release a statement saying Larson was a park employee. According to local laws and regulations, this would mean George Larson's death legally did not have to be reported to state regulators. Additionally, they would say that Larson's accident occurred at nighttime while it was raining. As if any of this would somehow make it okay. Larson's family would later release a statement, though, denying Action Park's claims. According to them, Larson did not and never did work for this water park. He did work as a ski lift operator a year prior for the resort, but this was separate from Action Park. It turned out riders jumping the curves on the Alpine slide was a regular occurrence, and this would lead the staff to eventually replace the rocks in the area with hay bales, but this took a long time to happen. At least 14 fractures and 26 head injuries came from this slide between 1984 and 1985 alone. There was also the Tarzan swing, and if you ask people who survived Action Park, This was the badge of honor if you were able to survive this thing. The Tarzan swing was a steel arch that hung from a 20-foot cable. It was essentially a rope swing, and patrons would wait in long lines for the chance to hang from it, swing out, and jump into the natural spring-fed water. In the park's early years, the area that patrons would jump from was not over the water, but rather a cushioned area. So some people would let go as soon as they started their swing, but this wouldn't be an issue because then they could just land in some cushions and then slide in the water. But for some reason, in the mid-1980s, they changed the starting position of the swing, and patrons had to swing over the water. So they started to have them stand on this platform before taking off. And for a lot of people, especially if they were quite tall, the swing was too low to the ground, so they were getting like foot injuries from scraping their feet along this platform. Others were able to hang on the whole time and get across the platform properly, but when they would land in the water, their bodies would quite literally go into shock because this water was natural spring-fed and it was ice cold. For some people, the water was so dangerously cold, it nearly caused them to drown. And in 1984, one unnamed rider would go into cardiac arrest after he landed in this freezing cold water on the Tarzan swing. He would suffer a fatal heart attack. They estimated the water at this time to be 50 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 degrees Celsius. There was also the kayak experience. This was an imitation whitewater course, and patrons would take their kayaks on the water, conquering waves that had been created by these electric fans that were circulating underneath the water. Because of its poor design, kayaks would often get stuck or they would tip over, and this happened to a rider one day on August 1st, 1982. It was a 27-year-old man from Fairlawn, New Jersey. His name was Jeffrey Nathan. And his kayak got stuck, it tipped over. So he ends up getting out of his kayak. He's standing on this metal grate so that he can flip the kayak back over and then get back on. But the problem was this metal grate was in contact with exposed live wiring for the underwater fans. So Nathan suffered a severe electric shock and went into cardiac arrest. Two of Nathan's relatives were also close by and witnessed all of this happen, and they themselves also suffered some shocks, but were luckily okay. At first, the park disputed any liability in this. They claimed that because no burns were found on Nathan's body, their equipment couldn't have caused his death. But the coroner would later say that burns generally do not occur in a water-based electrocution. The kayak experience was then drained and closed for investigation. The state's labor department would find the fan was properly installed and they maintained no violations of safety laws. They also said that amusement ride regulations had been properly followed. However, in this same report, they also stated 19 ampere electric current was flowing through a ground circuit 3 days after the incident, and this would suggest there was a deadly, strong presence of current in the underwater fan's motor circuit. The park ended up never opening the ride again, but they didn't verbalize any fault. Still, they said that the reason they didn't open it again was because people were just too afraid to ride it. The last attraction that I'm going to talk about in this episode is the Tidal Wave Pool. The attraction that would prove to be the most deadly. The Wave Pool opened at the beginning of Action Park's 1981 season, attracting tons of families. Patrons would hang out in inner tubes, or you could just swim. The pool held up to 1,000 people, and the waves would generate for 20 minutes, then stop for 10 minutes. The waves got incredibly high. They reached up to 40 inches or a meter in height and often went over swimmers' heads. Because of these high waves, the high volume of guests piling into this thing, and the water being deceptively deep, people nearly drowned on a regular basis. Action Park lifeguards were rescuing upwards of 30 people every single weekend. Patrons would be swept under the water after a big wave would crash down over them. Other times, swimmers would wear themselves out, having to swim continuously for 20 minutes because the waves were nonstop during that time. There were three known deaths in the tidal wave pool. On July 24th, 1982, 15-year-old George Lopez would drown. 2 years later, on August 27th, 1984, a 20-year-old from Brooklyn named Donald DePass would drown. And on July 19th, 18-year-old Gregory Grandchamps would drown. Action Park was permanently closed in 1996. The park owner's negligence led to six fatalities, including three drownings, one electrocution, one heart attack, and a fatal head injury. Not to mention the countless others who were injured over the years. Action Park would be involved in over 100 lawsuits, and the park was understaffed, undertrained, and undersupervised. It was being run by an executive team that was more interested in making money than protecting the safety of its patrons. Had the park not been forced to shut down, I have no doubt the death toll would have continued to have gone up. Despite this, in 2010, a stubborn and deranged Mulvihill would lead a committee to try to buy the park back. It reopened in 2014 with a new name, Mountain Creek Water Park, and it now advertises having a highly trained lifeguard staff, along with stringent, up-to-standards safety features. The park founder and CEO of Action Park, Gene Mulvihill, would die in his home on October 27, 2012, at the age of 78. He left behind his wife and his six children, and his cause of death has not been made public. If you want to learn more about this story, I get into a lot more of Gene Mulvihill's backstory. I talk a lot more about the employees at the park and a lot more of these rides on Patreon. So the next time you go to a water park, take caution and remember these stories that I've told you today. Remember the victims of the Banzai Pipeline slide disaster. Remember Caleb Schwab, the victim from the Verrucht slide, and those two unnamed sisters. Remember the six victims from Action Park. And those are the perplexing and horrifying stories of the Banzai Pipeline slide, the Verrucht slide, and Action Park. And if there's anybody listening or watching this that has been to any of these parks, I want to hear your story. Drop a comment down on YouTube or email me, perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail. Send me a DM on Instagram @perplexitymysterypodcast. I would love to hear your experience here. It sounds like these places, especially Action Park, were just crazy. If you did enjoy this episode and you haven't done so yet, please leave a 5-star review wherever you listen. If you're watching on YouTube, I would love if you hit the subscribe button. Remember, if you want ad-free episodes, early releases, and exclusive bonus content, patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast is where you can get all of that and much more. You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week and stay safe, and I will talk to you next week. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Perplexity, a mystery podcast, hosted, written, and produced by Kadra Brennan. If you enjoyed today's episode, tell the world about it by going to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leaving a 5-star review. It helps the show more than you know. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. And if you have a story to share or a topic request, send an email to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Kadra would love to read your story on the podcast. Until next week, stay curious.